This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the June 24th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. As our airwave television screens and print media continue to focus on last week's massacre of 9 black Americans by a homegrown white terrorist in Charleston, South Carolina's Story AME Church, I'm reminded of a phrase spoken by President Obama every time we have a mass killing. He says, "It's not who we are." Well, at best, it expresses the president's wishful thinking. It is who we as a people are, and have been since the first settlers from England arrived in what became our shores and began the genocide against the indigenous peoples whose lands they and their descendants would steal, and on which today, whether we like to think about it or not, we all now live. It has been who we are as a people since 1619, when Dutch traders brought the first African slaves to Jamestown, Virginia. 168 years later, for purposes of determining white representation in Congress, those brought in chains who came after them would be counted as three-fifths of a man by our founding fathers. Despite the election of Obama, African Americans are still considered less by our nation's police forces, and even less than that by every waver and defender of the Confederate flag, and by every white man or woman who rushed to buy themselves another gun, not only after Obama was elected, but also after his reelection, when gun sales soared by 400%. It is not a stretch to say they are soulmates of the Ku Klux Klan, the nation's first terrorist organization, which once enjoyed the support of such notables as President Woodrow Wilson and had in its ranks scores of Southern sheriffs. To his everlasting shame, Wilson had a private showing in the White House of one of the most racist films ever made, D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation. The film was based on a novel, The Klansman, by Tom Dixon, that glorified the white-sheeted terrorists and grossly distorted the history of post-Civil War Reconstruction, the only period in the history of the South when blacks were treated as full citizens. Moreover, it was instrumental in creating the racist stereotypes of African Americans that are still visible to this day. Today's program deals with another unattractive aspect of who we are. It's that character defect which requires American presidents and those aspiring to that office to boast to the world about our goodness, our exceptionalism, and our chosenness that requires us to intervene wherever and whenever we choose without regard to international law and the death and destruction we cause or leave behind. We have, in fact, been doing this outside our national borders virtually nonstop since we became a nation. The latest target is Ukraine. Before the coup last February that ousted the country's elected president from office, Victoria Nuland Kagan, Obama's Deputy Secretary of State for Europe, told an organization of Ukrainian Americans that the U.S. had spent $5 billion, that's right, $5 billion, to produce regime change in their homeland. You heard a live recording of her making that statement here on Takes on the World, where the craven mainstream media buried the story. One might ask why Obama, elected to office largely on the basis of his opposition to the Iraq War, had appointed the wife of leading neocon Robert Kagan, co-founder of the Project for New American Century, or PNAC, and an important neocon in her own right, to such a position, given that launching a war in Iraq was a cornerstone of PNAC's agenda. That's one of the questions I will ask award-winning investigative journalist Robert Perry when I speak with him at 20 minutes past the hour. On June 15th, on the blog Consortium News, Perry described how liberal interventionist Samantha Power, America's UN ambassador along with neocon allies, appears to have prevailed in the struggle over how President Obama will conduct his foreign policy in his last months in office, promoting aggressive strategies that will lead to more death and destruction. Yesterday, the Pentagon provided further evidence of that when the U.S. will place 250 tanks, Bradley fighting vehicles, and self-propelled howitzers throughout six European countries, five of which were part of the old Soviet Union or were its East Bloc allies. Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Romania, along with Germany, will have company to battalion-sized equipment sets located inside their territory under the new plan dubbed the European Activity Set. The gear is earmarked for use in training exercises, but Defense News, which carried the story, noted that it is hard to ignore the choice of nations that receive the equipment. With the exception of Germany, they are all physically close to Russia. Several, in the hope of receiving U.S. weaponry, have expressed concern that Russian President Vladimir Putin is looking to expand his country's regional control. That's a charge frequently made by Washington, but it has provided nothing to back it up. The U.S., however, has been using training exercises to reassure NATO allies since Russia's annexation of Crimea, long a part of Russia, in February 2014 in response to the coup in Kiev. Having the gear in place for future training exercises makes logistics easier, said Major James Brindle, Pentagon spokesman, who explained in Orwellian terms that, quote, to pre-position this equipment for these training events, it's a benefit for the taxpayers. It's a benefit for the soldiers. It's a benefit for everybody to have this equipment already there so they can just fall in much like we do at other training locations, he said. There are currently about 64,000 U.S. troops in Europe. The Pentagon's move was apparently in response to an announcement by Putin last week that Russia would respond to reports of Washington's planned expansion of its military deployments in Eastern Europe by increasing its nuclear arsenal. Speaking at a meeting with Finnish President Sauli Niinisto, Putin said, quote, if someone puts some of our territories under threat, that means we will have to direct our armed forces and modern strike power at those territories from where the threat emanates. As soon as some threat comes from an adjoining state, Russia must react appropriately and carry out its defense policy in such a way as to neutralize the threat against it, Putin added. Speaking at the opening of an exhibition of military hardware outside Moscow last Tuesday, Putin said, quote, this year, the size of our nuclear forces will increase by over 40 new intercontinental ballistic missiles that will be able to overcome any, even the most technologically advanced, missile defense systems. End quote. The United States slammed the announcement as a retrograde move reminiscent of the Cold War. Again, we'll be examining all of this with Robert Perry at 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned. Well, all of you are probably aware by now that President Obama's Pacific Rim Trade Pact moved closer to a final congressional vote yesterday when the Senate, by a 60-37 vote, agreed to limit debate on legislation that would grant Obama authority to speed trade deals through Congress. To reach the necessary 60-vote plateau required the support of 13 Democrats, one of whom was Dianne Feinstein. It would appear she did so, despite hundreds of phone calls from voters who kept her Washington phone lines busy without a break Monday and Tuesday morning. This is a strange behavior from a senator who has been among the upper chamber's leading advocates for transparency, because the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, as has been widely advertised, is so secret that members of Congress wishing to see it have to leave their cell phones and all writing instruments at the door. That was not the case, of course, with the corporate representatives who drafted it, one of whom in the pharmaceutical industry, I expect, will offer Obama a cushy job or contribution to his foundation, a la Bill Clinton, when he leaves the White House. It was Big Pharma, you should remember, that provided the major corporate backing for the Affordable Care Act after Obama gave the major drug companies veto power over the Act's drug provisions. A Senate vote giving the president's fast-track negotiating power is expected today. The bill itself now only needs a simple majority of 51 votes to pass. The notoriously anti-worker Republican leadership has promised to send Obama by the end of the week, maybe even today, a bill renewing an aid program for workers who lose their jobs as a result of the trade deals. The president says he wants both bills and has left open the possibility of waiting for Congress to send him both before signing fast track into law. Senators will also vote today to limit debate on a second bill extending trade benefits to African nations, which now also contains the worker aid program. On my next program, 2 weeks from today, when we will have more details, hopefully, about what was at stake and what we may have lost with the passage of the legislation. I'll be interviewing Patrick Woodall of Food Watch, who has been monitoring the progress of the TPA and TPP and speaking out publicly against their passage. In the meantime, with the June 30 deadline looming, the Jewish political establishment and pro-Israel front groups have escalated their efforts to kill any deal with Iran and the P5+1 countries that would allow Tehran to maintain any nuclear enrichment program or weapons with which to defend itself as well as its sovereignty. Self-styled experts from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, launched by AIPAC in 1985, and now the most influential foreign policy think tank in Washington, have been issuing policy papers, writing op-eds, and testifying before Congress against this legislation, against the Iran bill, over the past few weeks. Yesterday, one of the most thinly disguised of the pro-Israel operations, United Against Nuclear Iran, announced the launch of, quote, a multi-million dollar television, print, radio, digital, and grassroots campaign to educate and engage the American people and legislators in discussion of the critical issues remaining in negotiations with Iran over the future of its nuclear program. According to its press release, quote, the multi-tiered campaign will include national cable TV beginning on June 23rd, that was yesterday, and full-page newspaper ads in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. The campaign will continue through the time Congress casts votes on any final agreement on Iran's nuclear program reached by the P5+1 countries and Iran. It goes on, quote, this is a generationally important foreign policy issue, and we need to give full and appropriate analysis to each and every important element of an agreement with Iran, said United Against Nuclear Iran CEO Mark Wallace, a former U.S. ambassador to the UN, who will lead the campaign. As negotiations, he said, between Iran and the P5+1 enter the final stretch before a June 30 deadline to reach a final agreement, there is a growing concern that U.S. negotiators could be pressured into making changes in order to cement a deal, Wallace said. Democrats and Republicans, U.S. allies in the Arab world, and Israel, already feel that past concessions made to Iran go too far. They are increasingly worried, he says, that recent public statements from top Iranian officials, including Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, suggest the only way to conclude a deal with Iran is at the expense of our national security interests and those of our allies, end quote. Well, be assured, Wallace is merely a front man for the Israeli firsters on the organization's board of directors, which includes such luminaries as former Senator Joe Lieberman, Elliot Abrams of Iran-Contra infamy, and the ubiquitous Dennis Ross, who is also a part of the leadership team of the Washington Institute and has been described in Washington as Israel's lawyer. It is more than likely that much of the multi-millions funding the national ad and the campaign will come from the wallet of Sheldon Adelson, who has suggested in the past that Iran be nuked, and who recently launched another expensive campaign to defeat the boycott, sanctions, and divestment movement against Israel on America's college campuses, and it will probably be the man who chooses the next Republican candidate for president. But no one may have been made more of an effort to sabotage the Iran deal than Michael Oren, an American-born Jew who turned his back on his country, giving up his citizenship to become Israel's ambassador to the U.S. during Obama's first term. Oren has just released a book called Ally, in which he has the gall to accuse Obama of having betrayed Israel, and he pressured his publisher Random House to get the book out now in order to shoot down an agreement with Iran. I wrote the book, says Oren, and put rather immense pressure on Random House to bring it out, not in September or October, the book-selling period, but put it out in June now. Now, because Israel is at a crucial, I refer to as a fateful juncture, as an agreement, a nuclear deal with Iran approaches literally in the coming days. There are moments like this in American Jewish history, Oren continued, where American Jewry had an opportunity to intercede and perhaps save millions of Jews. And that moment was lost. I grew up in the shadow of that guilt and that horror, and it haunts me. I don't think at every moment is 1938, but don't get me wrong. I don't think Iranians are Nazis, but I have no doubt that given the opportunity, they will wipe us off the map because they say it and they're trying to do it, and we would be idiots not to think so, end quote. The book has been panned, even by pro-Israel advocates, for Oren's clumsy attempts to psychoanalyze Obama's behavior, that in the end tells readers more about the degree to which Oren, a trained historian, is himself emotionally disturbed. The truth of the matter, as a number of critics of Oren's books have pointed out, is that Obama has provided more military aid to Israel than any president before him, and his administration has consistently vetoed resolutions in the UN that would have penalized Israel. What Obama hasn't done, he hasn't expressed, is the abject love for Israel, as did Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and a willingness to publicly kiss Netanyahu's ring. Moreover, like those white Southerners who still embrace the Confederate flag, most Israelis of European origin are not shy about showing their distaste for people of color, even those who happen to be Jewish. That's a bit of the Israeli reality which I witnessed on both of my trips there. Finally, the UN Human Rights Council produced its report on Israel's assault on Gaza in 2014, which resulted in the death of over 2,000 Palestinians, most of whom were women and children, while 76 Israelis died, all but a handful of soldiers. It found that both Israel and Hamas were guilty of war crimes despite the vast disproportion in the death toll. The report itself was softer in the terminology describing Israel's destruction of Gaza, while being exceptionally hard in condemning Hamas's public execution of those it accused of collaborators with Israel. Collaborators have long been a problem for Palestinians, since Israel has frequently used blackmail to get Palestinians to inform for them on Palestinian activists. One reason for the less than harsh tone in dealing with Israel's crimes was that the presiding chair of the commission making the report lives in Brooklyn, which should be considered another occupied Israeli territory.